Kai would lose all face within the community if they took something with most often when a company who has underlying contracts gives something to the archive, they make a contract with the archive that it can be only used within reference to its own contracts. And now, of course, we're in this bind now because the library wants to do what the community wants, which is make our materials more available. So then we're in the point where the company can't give it because we want to give, because their contracts say you can't have further use, and we can't take it because they have to say we can have further use. So it's getting to be a little journey's knot that will be, I think, somewhat come out in the wash as copyright and usages and digital archives relax things, but until then, it's a bit of a bind.
It makes me wonder about just the idea of these contracts themselves, because there's a, besides just the graduate students who are making work, most likely not under contract, there's a huge range of our field where people were not concerned with contract. I mean, it just is like kind of under the radar or a different kind of radar. So I think that whatever processes that they did, and much of it oral, but other ways as well, I mean, there's no legal binding that's even visible at all.
Right.
So how that material is protected, how that material is still encouraged to be shared, I think is an interesting problem.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's, on the one hand, there's youthful modern dancers who are in college and they're dying to get their work out there.
Sure.
As well as people who are also unencumbered by any kind of contracts like ethnically specific style dancing, mm-hmm. who want to protect their rights as owners of the creation of that and want to protect it from being used in bizarre ways as, you know, commercials or whatever mm-hmm. ways that they have felt stolen from in the past. And, you know, particularly Native Americans, you know, and their materials and companies in archives are often now at risk of, if you ask them, can we preserve these or use it in some, you know, program, they'll often say, no, you must repatriate to our tribe. And
or actually, Karen has had her hand up for a minute. Let's just... Yeah.
Just to throw more into this. Miriam Phillips isn't here, but my colleague Miriam Phillips is a dance anthropologist, and we've been talking about the fact that there's so much indigenous work that has been videotaped and studied and investigated by dance ethnologists, and now those cultures perhaps are a little bit further along and they're aware that they're on YouTube
mm-hmm. yes.
and or around, and you know, no permissions were ever gotten, mm-hmm. no arrangements were ever made, so that stuff is basically excluded now, if you're going to be take the high moral ground on this, excluded from study. So it's a huge issue.
Yeah.
Well, but what I was going to say is, you know, I work a lot with the series in dance history and publishing books, and a lot of places are willing to do a DVD. So when I did choreographing difference, that I could have done a DVD with that book, which would have made it much more useful in terms of teaching from it. But even big companies didn't know where the contracts were, couldn't, you know, kind of release material, etc. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we just did Susan Reed's book on Sri Lanka, and because she's coming at it as an anthropologist, she had all the rights to videotape from the beginning because she was very thoughtful about that, because that's what, you know, kind of progressive anthropologists do. Mm-hmm. They explain what they're going to use the tapes for, how they're going to do it, you know, they get all the sign-offs. So she could do a DVD with her book. And I think that allowed it, you know, to kind of, because what happens is if you're not in charge of the digital images with the publication, then students just go anywhere on YouTube to try to find what makes sense, you know, with, and I've had students say, but I couldn't find anything about, you know, Pat Graney's company on YouTube kind of thing. And, you know, so it's interesting because they expect that to be the archive they can go to. And unless, you know, like you were saying with the artists who want to participate, unless we start to really be thoughtful about this stuff, that is what happens.
It was also interesting, I think, yesterday there was a, I think, difference between the nonprofit, the way that the nonprofit dancers viewed archiving and access, and the way that, for instance, Liza Gennaro, who choreographs musical theater, felt about her own work, in that there is still a commercially viable audience, I guess, for musical theater dance, in a way that it sounded like there wasn't quite so much anymore for some of the nonprofit dance. And so I think that she felt very much like she was, she needed to protect her dances, because often they will be taken from the, you know, the original production, which she may have been paid for, and then used without license fees or without, you know, any sort of credit in a community theater production or even a Broadway production later on. Yeah.
Okay. So this is terrific. It's like we're on to opening the space to say it's not all the same. Mm-hmm. It's really essential. It's like circulating through the comments.
Right.
And one thing that often happens when we get to digital is it is the same, or it seems to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So a challenge for us is to figure out how to make sense of the not sameness, so
right.
mm-hmm. the different approaches and ways to actually open these methodologies.
Mm-hmm.
I think what would happen if we opened oral history up much bigger, though, or in different kinds of directions?
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the rhetoric does assume that a narrative about the film would add a dimension. So David Gordon talking about the rehearsals and something. And that's true, but that's very 1995. Like, that's the director's track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would it really mean to open up oral history so that it was multivalent, so that it did include photographs of the space where the history happens? I'm thinking of phenomenology, and the histories tend to just offer the evidence of the conversation. But, you know, the experience of oral history involves sweat and smell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our technological resources are actually getting there. At least we can have more information until we figure out how to arrange the information or what to do with it. But I would love to see us start to open these categories up and kind of reimagine them so that oral history could include more than just film or audio, and I'm not sure what those other things are, but that'd be a great question to try to figure out.
Well, one of the things that we talked about yesterday, and David and others, about our work was made at a particular time, and that there's a reference not only to somebody else's work, but what else was happening. I mean, talking in another conversation about how one of my works was made premiered in January 2001, but then was reconstructed to perform in November 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So having gone through 9/11, what happens, and that is part of the fabric of the discussion of the oral history. So it goes in a whole nother plane of information.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point do you know, how wide a web can you?
Let's look.